You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Beware that child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Kia ora, that's Māori for hello. Māori is the indigenous language of New Zealand, and today I have on our very first Kiwi guest. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode with Arthur Haynes when we talked about what domestication has done to the nutritional value of foods and the effect this has had on our overall health. Next week, I'll be talking with Australian psychologist Robin Grill on everything from vacuum cleaners to climate change. If you are interested in learning about early infant memories, what a child and you can remember from those early years, be sure to check back next week. Today with movement specialist Hazel Boot, we talk about four components of natural human movement that are extremely significant in terms of the effect they have on the body, while at the same time take very little extra effort and time to incorporate into regular practice. These are all things that can be done by almost everyone, young children, older children, teenagers, those who are middle-aged or advanced in years, anyone on the male-female spectrum, including anyone who is pregnant or hoping to conceive one day. During the interview, Hazel and I mentioned jandals, which is the name us Kiwis use for the footwear that you North American and British listeners call flip-flops and the Australians call thongs. I really enjoyed this chat with Hazel. We continued talking for a good quarter of an hour after this interview ended about, of all things, trees. I had recently learnt how trees communicate underground through mycelium, and she recommended a book called The Hidden Life of Trees.
Year old movement specialist Hazel Boot was born in Geraldine, grew up in Peel Forest in South Canterbury. She currently lives in Christchurch, New Zealand with her partner Gemma. Hazel completed her degree in exercise and sports science from the University of Otago in 2003. In 2009, she studied humanistic neurolinguistic psychology. In 2015, Hazel finished her anatomy trained structural integration studies with Tom Myers. In 2017, she became a MoveNat Level 1 certified trainer, and most recently, she completed her restorative exercise certification with Katie Bowman from Nutritious Movement. Hazel has 10 years of experience in corporate health and movement consulting. She currently works as a health consultant, structural integrator, and movement specialist at Mind and Movement in Christchurch. She teaches movement to corporations and individuals. She also works one-on-one with those looking to recover and enhance their movement capabilities. Last night, she had 11 hours of sleep, and for dinner last night, she had steak with kumara, onions, mushrooms, and salad. Hazel, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
I found you while looking to see if natural movement had made its way to New Zealand yet, and I stumbled upon you in my hometown of Christchurch. How did you first come across natural movement?
Probably when I was really little, running around outside with my brother and sister. But as a kind of catchphrase, I definitely kind of started thinking about it a long time ago. I was running a study in an island in Northwest Australia, and we were doing a lot of functional movement screening and then helping people to get more, you know, movement in their joints and whatnot. And I just had this day in a gym where we were all working and doing really well, but I was just like, whoa, what are we all doing in here? There is nothing natural about any of the movements that these guys are going through. They're all really rigid and supported, and you know, people weren't doing things quite as I would have liked them to be doing, and they were doing things on machines, which meant that, you know, movement patterns that are normally well established weren't being used. And so I was like, oh, he's training that quad, but his opposite hip stabilizers are not getting the workout they need for that movement. So I started looking then for better kind of movement options and started following people like you just mentioned, Katie and Uwan Lacour at MoveNat, and just started getting into some of the stuff that they were doing and started spending a lot more time outside myself and just moving and just through more natural environments.
Mm-hmm. My understanding of natural movement is that exercise is movement, but movement is not always exercise. and we're always moving to some extent, so that maybe 1 hour of exercise a day is great, but what's even more important is how we're moving in the other 23 hours of the day. So rather than being like an exercise regime, I interpret natural movement as like a living regime, I guess, guiding us on how to move naturally, as in the way our bodies have evolved to move all of the time. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. Like there are a lot of people talking about this at the moment. Katie Bowman just recently released a kind of research article all about movement ecology, and she goes through the definitions of what natural human movement is, what, you know, physical activity is versus what exercise is. And yeah, exercise is, you know, it's great. In the culture where you're not moving, if you're getting some kind of exercise, then that might in fact save your life, but it's definitely not what we evolved doing. And so normally when people do a lot of exercise, they will end up with some kind of long-term injury. But in saying that, if you're not doing any movement at all, I would say it's definitely better to exercise than to do nothing. So yeah, natural human movement, from my perspective, is a human moving through their natural environment to kind of get the jobs that they need to get done to live. And not many of us are really doing that, I wouldn't suggest. There are lots of practices of natural movement that you can kind of bring into your day, but I still really think of them as kind of, they kind of really are exercise, because it's like, oh, let me do my natural movement. And from that perspective, it is kind of just like doing exercise. But if you're out there just interacting or getting up and over a mountain or whatever, then, you know, I consider that kind of natural movement in your natural environment. But I mean, there are lots of bodies out there that haven't been doing much movement. So to transition them wisely into natural movement, natural human movement, you need to take them through those processes and give them the skills and the ranges of mobility in their joints that they're missing simply because they haven't been practicing it. And so I think that's really, really important.
Okay, so I came across Erwin LaCour in MoveNet last year, and I'm quite familiar with Katie Bowman's restorative exercise, but I haven't heard of Tom Myers or anatomy trained structural integration. So I wondered if we could begin by you giving us a brief introduction to these three strands and telling us, you know, what are the similarities and differences between them all.
Okay, cool. So Tom Myers is the guru, one of the gurus in the world of fascia, and he wrote a book a very long time ago now. It was probably released sometime, might have been early 2000s, it's just called Anatomy Trains, Myofascial Lines and Meridians. And I read it as soon as I had finished university. And in it, he has dissected out a lot of what he calls anatomy trains, which are lines of connective tissue. So he didn't cut, he pulled. And he dissected out these beautiful lines, let's say, starting with all of the fascia and muscle on the top of the foot, going up into tibialis anterior, which is a muscle along the front of the shin, up into the quad, then switching through what he calls a switch into the rectus abdominis, up the front of the body, then into the sternochondral fascia, and up into the neck. So when I read this book and saw all of these lines of connective tissue, I was just like, why did nobody teach me this at university? Because there is no denying that there are these connections. And when I finished uni and went off into the world and started working and using the techniques I'd been taught, I found that a lot of them didn't really work. And I had to work out what did work, and Tom's stuff really worked. So I had wanted to study with him for a really long time. And he teaches a series of myofascial release sessions. So basically what happens is somebody comes in for a session. We do a really thorough kind of postural analysis, or I like to talk about alignment, not posture. Posture, people have got lots of weird ideas about posture. And Katie Bowman says that, you know, alignment is about how something works, and posture is about, you know, what something looks like. And we've got some interesting values about, you know, like most people want to thrust their rib cage, which compresses their lower back, and they think that open chest is really good posture, but it's actually really poor alignment. So we'll go through and see where you're out of alignment with yourself, where you have, you know, bends, tilts, shifts, rotations in the body. And then we'll release the parts that we can release through doing myofascial release. And then I will give you a whole lot of normally restorative exercise or some move net stuff to help you practice keeping those areas of your body open, so we can transition your body into more and more and more movement and getting more parts of you moving. I really like Tom and Katie both really talk about, like, Katie uses the analogy of nutrition in terms of movement. So like her company is called Nutritious Movement, but Tom's been using that analogy for a really long time. Like, these inputs into the body is a nutritional input. This movement into the body is a nutritional input. And if you're not getting certain parts of your body, if movement is not being experienced by certain parts of your body, let's say your thoracic spine, then, you know, those areas are not going to be well nourished in terms of, you know, how much blood flow is there, how much oxygen they're getting, how much nutrients they're getting, and how much toxins are getting taken away. So Tom is really into developmental movement patterns and understanding how kids develop through their developmental movement patterns. We did a lot of really cool stuff with him in that field. And basically he was the first person that kind of let me know that modern groups of hunter-gatherer children go through their developmental movement patterns 2 to 3 months ahead of Western children. Mm-hmm. And that, I was just like, wow, really? Why? You know? And then he's really illuminated me as to the fact that we interfere with children's development through the things we put them in, the devices we use with them, like shoes, like car seats, like strollers. We restrict their movement and we cast their hips to certain positions by having them in things which, of course, are necessary. You know, like, nobody wants to put their baby in a car seat, in a car without a car seat. But there are just so many things that really fascinate me with adults later, seeing how potentially this issue or this pattern that they have now was developed a really long time ago because something was restricted when they were trying to wire up their brain and their body through going through their developmental movement patterns. And the, like, everybody's talking about this at the moment, but I mean, like, shoes are really restrictive a lot of the time for children. You know, the soles are so stiff that a child can't even bend the sole, so it's getting very little movement into their foot. And I was actually chatting with a brilliant human yesterday, Carla Hannaford. She wrote a really great book called Smart Moves, Why Learning is Not All in the Head. She wrote that a long time ago now. I think it was 1995. And she just talks about the fact that, you know, when you've got a shoe on your foot, you don't get to develop balance when you're young, which means that your vestibular apparatus never gets to kind of fully develop, which can really affect your hearing. And so when a kid is maybe challenged with their hearing, we don't think, oh, take off their shoes. We just go, what's going on with their hearing? You know, we don't kind of see this pattern that of basically intrusion. We've intruded into the mobility in their foot. We've intruded into that child walking on those feet and trying to find that balance and practice balance, because we've really, you know, we've taken away their adaptable foot by casting it in what Tom calls a foot coffin or a foot desensitization chamber. And yeah, then we can cause all kinds of problems without even realizing it. And the thing is that most parents, they don't know this, and they think they're protecting their child's feet, which, you know, they're trying to be great. They're trying to be great parents. And that's the thing that we, I think a lot of people just don't know. And the more we can talk about these kind of things, it's important.
Mm-hmm. I wondered then if you could talk more about shoes, like, you know, what should we be looking at? You mentioned, like, the like, we're wanting a flexible sole. What else? What other facets of a shoe?
Yeah, well, all of the normal things. You want your foot to be able to do what it's supposed to do, which is have really wide toes. I had a client in a while ago, and she had just been over to Fiji, and she was like, you should see their feet. Like, they're just big and so wide. And I'm like, that's an awesome foot. Like, that is how our feet should be. They should be so wide and so spread. And she was just like, oh, they were just so big. And I was like, yeah. We want, you know, to have a really wide toe box so that our toes can splay. We want to have no heel on our shoe so that our superficial backline or our, you know, our Achilles tendon is not getting shorter and shorter and shorter every day just simply from wearing the shoe. When minimal shoes came in, you know, 10 years ago, there were all these Achilles tendons being ruptured left, right and center. And that's because nobody transitioned into these shoes. They were like, they'd been wearing an Asics running shoe with a, you know, 1-inch heel for 10, 20 years. And then these new shoes came out and they just put them on, went for a run and were inadvertently asking their Achilles tendon to be about an inch longer than it was. And of course it wasn't. So they were ruptured. So yeah, you need a wide toe box, a really flat sole, no heel at all, hopefully no toe rocker. You'll notice a lot of shoes these days kind of curl up around the toes. And you want them to be able to stay on your foot without your foot having to do any work. So if it's a sandal, you want it to be completely, you know, comfortable. You don't, like, jandals are bad, which is unfortunate because lots of Kiwis love wearing them. But yeah, you have to grip your toes, which really does change the way your foot's working. I mean, like, try running a pair of jandals and you'll very quickly cut them off. It's just not fun. So yeah, unfortunately jandals, even though they are very minimal, I think a lot of people get the minimal means they have minimal effect on your foot. So your foot gets to do what it would do if it was walking on a natural surface. And that's something you need to talk about as well, because I've got some very minimal shoes, but I will never wear them on an unnatural surface. So I don't wear them on, like, you know, even something like that, because that is very unnatural for my barefoot to be walking on this really hard surface over and over and over again. And it's a flat surface as well, which again is very unnatural for a foot. So, but if I'm going up into the hills, I spend a lot of time up in the Port Hills around the Crater Rim out on Banks Peninsula here, and I will wear a very minimal shoe. My favorite shoe to wear at the moment is a Soft Star moccasin, and they're very, very minimal. But I started wearing minimal shoes about in 2011, and that minimal shoe wasn't that minimal, you know. So I've spent a long time transitioning my feet and strengthening my feet so that is comfortable for my feet to do now.
Right, yeah. So like what you said, as adults, since we've had probably decades of wearing damaging footwear, that children wouldn't need to go through that. Children wouldn't need to go through that transition if they start off with either minimal footwear or being barefoot as often as possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, if we can restrict the amount of devices we use with children and get them moving and, you know, sitting on the floor instead of sitting in these you know, child size seats and all of those things, we're just going to keep their hip mobility. They're never going to have to regain their hip mobility. When I was doing my MoveNet level one, I did it with this really cool guy, Matt Rutley. He was an awesome dude. And he said that, you know, a lot of people ask him, you know, how did he get his deep squat? And he was just like, I never lost it. And that's luckily the same for me. Like, I never lost the ability to be able to get my body into a deep squat, because I grew up on a farm. I spent a lot of time outside, you know, running around. I did sit on the floor a lot. It's just a very natural thing to kind of do. My family, when I was little, we'd go to O'Kane's Bay for a few weeks or a month and just run amok out there every summer. So this whole idea of lots of clients want to be able to do a certain thing. We all know that the squat pattern is really important and we can't do it. And that's just because we haven't been doing it. So if you don't want to lose the ability to do something, all you've got to do is keep doing it. And hip mobility is something that's so important for all of us in terms of our health. And we lose it because we just don't use the full range of mobility, because we sit on chairs all the time and never express that full range of motion of our hips.
Mm-hmm. When you say this, I think of my 3-year-old who, like, it's just amazing to see how deep he can sit with his feet just so flat, and he's just comfortable there. Like,
yeah,
to me, I could not be that comfortable unless I was sitting flat on the ground. If I could do that.
Yeah, and your body can do that. It's just got to spend time changing, developing better squatting facets and with time, your body can absolutely change back to getting into that position if done, you know, wisely and gradually.
Oh, that would be ideal. So I wanted to talk about, where we could get some shoes for, like, maybe for children. I know that, water shoes can be quite easy to source and cost effective. Do you have any other suggestions?
Well, most of my knowledge on this area comes from Katie Bowman. She has a page on her website where she has a huge list of the kind of shoes. She talks about, like, water shoes are very cheap. A lot of the companies that make barefoot shoes are great, but they tend to be kind of expensive. Soft Star is a great company. Vivo Barefoot's a great company. They have great shoes. But it'd be really cool to have a Kiwi company making some really nice minimal shoes.
Yeah.
Anybody want to start making minimal shoes in New Zealand? That would be awesome. And then we wouldn't have to pay for the shipping to come into the UK, come in from the US or the UK. And of course, making things locally and whatnot, is saving on those fossil fuels is definitely a great thing. So yeah, if anybody wants to start making minimal shoes, go for it.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so while to add on from where you were talking about squatting, I guess, should we now start talking about furniture as casts, in particular, like chairs and sitting?
Yeah, it's not something a lot of people think about. When you're born into an environment, that environment just becomes normal, and you think, why would we do anything any differently? Because this is just how things have always been. But when you have an understanding of what movements the body requires to be able to keep moving in that certain way, like there's a very simple, you know, sit to rise test, which three Brazilian universities and Stanford University did this really great study where they worked out, a really simple test, which is, can you get down on the ground from a standing position without, like, using your hands or your knees, you know, just sit straight down. And if you can, that's 5 out of 5. And if you can't, you know, if you have to put one hand down, then you lose a point. So you get kind of 4 out of 5 for getting down. And it's the same on the way up. Like, can you get up off the ground without using your hands or your knees to kind of push you up? And the results were astounding. Like, if you scored under 8, which is still quite a high score, over the next 6 years, your chances of dying were, I think it was significant. It was 5 times greater or something. So having mobility in your body is really important. And a lot of us don't think about it because we're just born into these environments where couch sitting is normal. And then we lose this mobility and we're like, why have I lost this mobility? And so I think it's just really letting people know that sitting on the floor, like ground sitting, and there are many different positions that we would have sat in. And, you know, like if you're outside, going for a walk, going for a tramp or a hike, and you sit down on, you know, on the natural world around you, it's a very different position, and it always is, as a result of, you know, that specific environment that you're sitting on. And so we've been cast. Like, when I'm doing presentations, I quite often talk about the fact that we wear chairs. Like, it's almost like they're part of our clothing because we just have them on us all the time. And that 90 degree kind of hip flexion when you're sitting in a chair just becomes the only kind of range that your body is capable of, because it's the only range that your body frequents on a regular basis. So if you slowly start to expand those ranges of motion, you know, by sitting on cushions on the chair or by sitting on a slightly lower chair, sitting on cushions on the floor, sitting on a slightly lower chair, all of those things can slowly introduce new loads into the tissues that haven't really been getting any for a really long time.
Yeah, I see. I quite like the idea of, instead of a dining table and chairs, having maybe like a low coffee table and cushions or blankets to sit directly on the floor. I think it's quite similar to what's practiced widely in Asia.
Yeah, I lived in Japan for a year and a bit, and my mobility was awesome. Like, when I first got there, I was like, whoa, this is kind of uncomfortable sitting on the floor. But by the end of it, I was just loving it. And that was kind of my body just going like, oh yeah, if you don't use a certain range of motion, you just lose it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And yeah, Japanese, they squat beautifully as well. They sit on the floor so wonderfully. They have just amazing hip mobility. And it's got to be good for you, you know?
Yeah. Could you talk a bit about tucking the pelvis when we're sitting and what that's doing?
Yeah, so many people, so if your pelvis is like a bowl, this is an analogy many people use. I don't know if you guys understand what, you know, you've got your ASIS on the front, which is the bony bit at the front of your hip, or the anterior superior iliac spine. And then most of us want to have our body in a neutral position. So a really easy way to see if your pelvis is in neutral, well, it's not actually that easy if you don't understand the anatomy, but is your ASIS and your pubic symphysis. So both ASISs and your pubic symphysis, which is the bony bit in the, right at the front of your pelvis, are they on the same when you're standing? Are they on the same vertical plane? Or when you're lying, are they on the same horizontal plane? So that's what we're looking for. And most people, well, many people, not all, most people when we see them in standing have an anterior thrust of their pelvis or an anterior shift. So it's actually more over their foot than what we'd like. And some people have what we call a posterior tilt as well. Some people have an anterior tilt, but it's more common to see people with this posterior tilt, which means if that pelvis was a bowl of soup, you'd kind of be pouring soup out the back, or that pubic symphysis is going to be in front of the ASIS. It's going to be not on the same vertical plane in standing. So many people have that, and it's just because of the position that they frequent a lot. They sit on their pelvis on their sacrum, rather than sitting kind of, I don't like the word sit bones because I don't believe that I don't believe that they are sit bones, but that's a word that they get called. But we sit like right back tucked on our sacrum instead of sitting on those ischial tuberosities, which is what I like to call them. And so the tissue, our hamstrings get tight, our calf muscles are generally really tight due to shoes and due to the fact that a lot of us are stressed all the time and therefore kind of get stuck in that kind of survival position or that startle reflex, which actually does make your calf muscles shorter and thrusts you onto the front of your foot so that you're ready to sprint away from something that might be dangerous to you. So I've very much in the past looked at the position of the body based on just how it's been positioned, but how stressed it is also very indicative of the posture our body will end up assuming. So yeah, lots of us have these tucked pelvises in that posterior position, which just means that the forces, you know, the gravitational forces going through our bodies is not how they should be, which just basically means that certain tissues are experiencing more load than they should be and other tissues are experiencing less load than they should be.
Yeah. Is there a link there then between some of the ailments that are usually blamed on pregnancy, such as like diastasis recti and incontinence and other things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like a lot of people who have diastasis recti, which is the separating of the linear alba between the rectus abdominis, they've had a pressure problem in their that cavity for a long time. So when they add a baby in there, that pressure problem just gets worse. Because, I mean, not everybody gets a diastasis recti. It's not something that should happen with pregnancy, and it's not something that happens a lot. And I believe in populations that move a lot and more in their natural environment. So that thrust of the pelvis, that anterior shift of the pelvis that I was talking about, generally creates a lot more pressure in that abdominal cavity, which will increase the amount of stress that the linear alba experiences. So Yeah, one of the best ways, like I haven't had any babies and I'm not an expert on this at all, but one of the best ways to, you know, prepare for having a baby is to have a baby inside you. For that load to increase very slowly in size. But if you've got a thrust pelvis, so your femur is kind of anteriorly tilted and your pelvis is out in front of, you know, where the load should be coming down into your calcaneus bone in your foot, then yeah, that pressure problem will be exaggerated.
Mm-hmm. Before we started the interview, we were talking about sleep and how important that is. Could you maybe talk a bit about how we evolved to sleep and natural sleep?
Actually, I can, because I just read a book about this. I read a book called Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker, which is incredible, and I highly recommend any human reads it. Well, in my work, I find that my clients in chronic pain or any kind of pain actually will get vastly better when they start to work on their sleep. And we know that when we are well rested, the pain that we experience just goes down. And when we are less stressed, the pain that we experience in our body goes down, because pain is a very biopsychosocial phenomenon. It's not just about tissue damage. It's about, you know, the experience of our life, basically. So in regards to sleep, yeah, it's very important for creating a healing environment. So when we sleep, there are so many incredible things happening in our body that, you know, I'll just mention a few of them. One study that I read in the book, you know, like they got a bunch of people to sleep for 8 hours, and they did some testing on their immune function, specifically something called your natural killer cells, which kill, tumors and cancerous cells. And then they restricted the same bunch of people to 4 hours of sleep for one night. And then they retested. And 70% of their natural killer cells had disappeared or were no longer active after one night. And that just absolutely blew my mind. I was like, wow, one night of short sleep can put you in a state of, you know, severe immune dysfunction. And so that's, you know, one example. And in terms of like sleep, we're coming back to children, was another really interesting study where they, in Minnesota, they changed the sleep times. So kids were having to go to school at 7:20. And in one particular school, they changed it to 8:55. So the children, especially teenagers, because teenagers' patterns will shift forward, meaning that they don't get into really deep sleep until quite early in the morning, well, late in the morning, actually, like 7-8 o'clock. So if they have to get up at that time and go to school, their brain doesn't get to do all this amazing processing that needs to happen for that child to be able to learn, to be able to grow properly and all of those things. So they shifted it forward. And the, you know, the average kind of SAT, and that doesn't mean a lot to me, but I don't understand what that means in terms of the American system. But I do understand what it means when they say that the SAT the year after, most the top kind of the top kids at the school were getting 600 and 700 kind of SAT standards and various testing, and all of their SAT scores went up about 200 points, which is astounding apparently. And the other thing was that in that area, the rate of accidents, car accidents between 16 and 18 year olds decreased by 70%. Just because these children were recovered in their brains and whatnot. So sleep is, I believe, one of the most under, you know, in terms of moving well in your body, in terms of a lot of things, sleep's important. Like in the corporate health work that I do, I like to discuss, you know, at the start, just kind of take a really broad kind of snapshot at what we're talking about. And I'll draw a smiley face on the board and I'll say, this is a happy cell. And then I'll say, you know, for the cell to experience its optimal biological function, what does it need? And people will say, oh, it needs, you know, like optimal food. And I'll be like, yeah, great. And then they'll say it needs optimal movement. And then somebody will talk about sleep. And then somebody will normally bring up it needs, you know, it needs love, it needs connection. And I'm like, great. They're kind of the four the four broadest categories that we could, you know, create. And then I'm like, okay, so what did we do before? And I say before because somebody might say, oh, my grandmother used to eat a lot more, you know, just veggies and meat. Or some people will say, like, you know, before the agricultural revolution or whatnot, we used to do this. So I say, what did we do before and what do we do now? And when we're talking about, say, food, you know, what do we do before? People will be like, oh, we ate wild vegetables and wild fruit and wild meats and those things. What do we do now? We eat processed food. In terms of movement, you know, what did we do? We used to be constantly moving, changing our positions and whatnot. And what do we do now? We sit down all day. In terms of love and connection, what did we used to do? We used to live in tribes. We used to live in communities. What do we do now? We live in individual, you know, houses. We live in nuclear families. Lots of people live alone. And in terms of sleep, what did we used to do? And I think before wonderful old Edison invented the light bulb, most people, and that was like in the late 1800s, most people were getting 10 hours of sleep. In 1942 in America, that went down to 7.9 hours. And currently in America, it's, I think it's 6.5. So we know that people need at least 7 hours. The recommendations is between 7 and 9. And that's because we know that we see, you know, cognitive dysfunction and physiological dysfunction at anything less than 7. So I had a concussion just over a year ago. And sleep was a very important part of my recovery. And, you know, last night I got 11 hours. I don't always get 11 hours, but I'll get like over 9 most nights because I didn't realize, and this is kind of part of general adaptive syndrome, you know, like when you're really, really stressed out, you don't realize how stressed out you are. And so when you're really, really underslept, you don't realize how underslept you are. And then when you actually get some more sleep, you're like, whoa, I feel way better. And so I've continued to kind of play with that because I just feel way better when I'm well rested. And when I was chatting with Carly yesterday, I talked about the fact I lived in Melbourne for a very long time, and I came back here to New Zealand for a family holiday and was blown away by how relaxed I felt here. And then when I went back to Melbourne, I was just like, whoa, this place is intense, you know? And because I was so in it, I just didn't notice it. And then when I removed myself from it and went back, I kind of noticed it. And I think that's very much happened to me now, that I've realized how great I feel when I sleep really well. Now, when I don't allow myself enough time to sleep, you know, which happens sometimes, I'm just like, whoa, I feel like shit. And I know it's because I haven't slept. So I make a priority of sleeping more the following night, or getting a nap if I can, just because I've, you know, through reading this book and having the experience of the concussion, I've just realized how much better I feel when I sleep really well. And kids need heaps of sleep, and most children are not getting enough sleep. And so that's another thing, another way we can help them to really, you know, wire up their brains so that they have every chance of, you know, coming into the world and having these amazing brains that can solve the kind of problems that are arriving in the world currently.
Yeah, thank you for that. That was so informative. Could you talk about beds, bedding and pillows and mattresses, and how that affects our movement in terms of sleep?
Yeah, I am going to do Te Aroroa, which is the long walk from the top of New Zealand to the bottom of New Zealand at the end of 2020. And after that, I'm going to completely ditch my bed because I would have been sleeping on the ground or on a very thin mattress for probably 4 or 5 months while I do that. So lots of people will probably be familiar with the experience of going camping and finding your body is so used to really soft surfaces that it's really uncomfortable. I get a lot of my clients to transition out of using a pillow because, you know, not using a pillow is like stretching your neck all night, right? And when you cast it to a certain position, every night by, you know, supporting it, it loses its mobility. And one way to restore more mobility to your neck is to not support it all night so that it's actually supporting itself. The same idea as a shoe, you know, if a foot, a strong foot doesn't need support from a shoe or an orthotic, you know, a really healthy, strong neck doesn't need support from a pillow. So if you've been somebody that's used the pillow for a really long time, transition out of it slowly. And I took like 2 years to transition. And Katie talks a lot about this on her website as well, but just, you know, going from a bigger pillow to a slightly smaller pillow to a slightly smaller pillow. But yeah, the things, have a think about the things you use in your life and what movement they restrict your body from. Say like a shoe is really obvious. Quite often it squishes your foot together and restricts all of those 33 joints in your foot from moving and articulating individually. But people don't tend to think about a chair and how that's casting your hips to a certain degree, or how, you know, you're so comfortable in this, this, you know, soggy, well, not soggy mattress, but like a saggy mattress, that you stay in one position all night, so you're not actually getting movement. But sleeping on harder surfaces is a way of getting more movement into your body. It's a way of getting more pressure. You know, we go to people for massages these days so they can push on your body, when a hard surface will push on your body all night for free. And I mean, Katie Bowman really is the person to talk to there. She has transitioned all of her family to sleeping on the floor without pillows. And I think they are currently doing most of their sleeping outside as well. So,
wow.
Yeah. If you want to talk in detail about that, have a yarn to Katie.
Yeah. Well, we've just, my husband just made our first sheepskin rug.
Oh, cool.
And we're like, oh, I wonder if we can get to a point in the future where we can use that, we can just make maybe eight sheepskin rugs and like all lie on them for our beds.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Katie's put a really cool video up on her website not that long ago where, it's just her picking up the bedding from the floor in their bedroom, and she's showing you this awesome kind of squatting shoulder workout that she gets every morning for 5 minutes while she packs up the bed, and every evening for about 5 minutes while she's putting the bed down on the ground. So it's just another way of getting more movement into your life. That's one of the things I really loved about living in Japan, is when you woke up, you picked up your futon, you rolled it up, you picked up all your blankets, you put them away in the cupboard, and then at night you got them all out, which I didn't really think about at the time as a whole lot more movement in your day, but it definitely is. So, and yeah, when you're, you know, when you get up and down off the ground a lot, you just have way better strength in your legs and hips, and sleeping on the floor is a way of getting that to be a consistent part of your day.
Yeah, I like that. I hope to get there eventually.
Yeah.
So we've talked about bare feet and sleeping and sitting, and I also wanted to cover like the exposure to different temperatures.
Yeah. So our body is designed, has this incredible system of keeping our core temperature in this, you know, really tight kind of window. And it has, of course, ways of distributing more blood to the skin so we can exchange heat with the environment, or, you know, of our little cilia, our little hairs prickling up our, you know, making us get goose pimples and pricking our hairs on end so that we can trap more heat and keep more heat close to our skin. And our body needs to practice those skills to be good at those skills. And if we're constantly in environments that are set in temperature inside, then our body really doesn't get that practice. And that means that, you know, your cells aren't experiencing loads. Like, that is a load for your for those little tiny muscles that erect your that pull your hairs up. They're not getting used. So that'll mean a decrease in their function, a decrease in blood flow. And it's ultimately not what we want. So I know sometimes I will go out, it's getting really colder and colder, and I'm noticing that my body over summer has adapted to having more of my capillaries closer to my skin to exchange heat. And now what's going to happen is my capillaries are going to retreat and not be as close to the surface of my skin so that I can maintain a bit of temperature. But if I go out there and I don't wear quite enough clothing, then I know my body is getting some practice at using these muscles that it, if I was a, you know, a wild human living out in nature, my body would just be exposed to all the time. And, you know, if you think about, I was out for a walk the other day and the weather changed really quickly and I had all the things that I needed to keep my body warm. But I, you know, I thought of the early, the Māori and the Moriori, and, you know, their bodies would have just been so used to those things happening that they, you know, and they would have been reading the weather so well that they probably wouldn't have found themselves in the situation that I was in. But yeah, they just, it's that, it's just something that we don't even really think about, you know, your body being able to do the things that physically it's capable of doing that we've restricted by, you know, all these wonderful clothes and, you know, warm environments inside. But it's actually kind of meaning that our body is missing certain movements, even if that is just in a tiny, tiny muscle pulling up a hair that is vital for, you know, that cellular function.
See, so I've heard of it as being described as metabolic exercise. Could you explain what that is?
I've never heard that before, metabolic exercise. So, but I mean, like, your metabolism is, you know, based on keeping your body at a certain temperature and, you know, burning sugars and fuels and whatnot to make sure that you can stay at that, you know, it's a really, you know, 32 point whatever degrees it is, I can't remember right now, but you've got to stay within this really narrow range for your cells to be able to carry out their function. And so metabolic exercise, yeah, I suppose it's just a challenge. We all know that with, you know, if you want to get fitter or stronger, you increase the demand. And so if you want your, you know, that you, these cells, you increase the demands, you increase the exposure to, say, low temperatures or hotter temperatures so that physiologically the body can just carry out those things that it needs to carry out. That's cool though, metabolic exercise. Like, I suppose it's kind of, you know, it's that idea of cellular movement, cellular, you know, really on the cellular level as opposed to on that, the big macro level. But yeah, does that kind of explain it?
Yeah, no, it does. Thank you. So we traveled through Finland and we stayed at a friend's family lakeside cabin, and it's a common Finnish ritual to sit in a sauna and then jump in a lake.
Yeah.
And we did it, and we keep repeating it because, you know, it was just so enjoyable.
Yeah.
But it's such a common practice in Finland. They have enough saunas, I think it's for one for every four people.
Yeah.
And then they've also got hundreds of thousands of lakes.
Yeah, they love that stuff.
Yeah, they swear that by doing this ritual regularly, your body will cope better with stress and also help the immune system to grow stronger. Is that?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's environmental exposure, like being exposed to the environment, you know, in a way more kind of natural setting where you're kind of semi-naked getting in and out of hot water and into really freezing cold water is, it's a bit of a shock to the system and whatnot. I mean, I had a client a while ago who decided that he was going to expose himself to a bit of environmental kind of therapy, so to speak. And so he was going to have a really cold shower in the morning, and he just ended up with this horrendous cold for like a month. And so I was like, there's other ways that you can, you know, give your body this exposure to cold. But I mean, like, these Finns have been doing it their entire lives,
yeah,
which is awesome. And I mean, as a foreigner coming in and doing that, I mean, I bet you there's a lot of foreigners that get sick, okay, you know, because they're not used to this kind of hot cold. But if you keep doing it, your body will absolutely learn to you know, deal with it. And I absolutely, yeah, I can't think off the top of my head now what would be, you know, the physiological responses to help with stress. But I mean, it is a stress on the system, so it's a stress to go from a hot to a cold to a cold to a hot. So that's, you know, an absolutely a valid way, I believe, to help your system be able to deal with stress.
It sounds a lot like what you've talked about with everything else today, is that transition, that it's not quite so stressful if you have slowly transitioned to doing it regularly.
Yeah, and it's even less stressful if you never transitioned out of it,
Christ. Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, like I talk a lot about in these workshops I do about optimal biological function. Like, what is it? What does it mean? And I've kind of come to believe that the last people that ever experienced like optimal biological function were people running around before the agricultural revolution, you know, when their bodies were really exposed to the environment that they evolved in. So optimal biological function is your cells having the inputs and, you know, that they need to be able to carry out the tasks that they have to carry out on, you know, in terms of metabolism, in terms of, you know, or the immune function, in terms of every system in your body, you know, carrying out its tasks. And those inputs are vital, you know, like sleep is a vital input, movement is a vital input, you know, food is a vital input, the nutrition from food and love and connection is a vital, vital input. I mean, I don't think a lot of people understand just how important connection and love is for your cellular function. I don't know if you've ever heard of a study called the Grant Study. It's a big longitudinal study that's been run out of Harvard for a very long time now. And George Valiant, who was the head of the study for a long time, he's written, I think, 4 or 5 books on the study. And in one of the books, they were looking back to see what was at 50, what was the biggest predictor of somebody having a heart attack at 60? So this is when all of these people were, you know, past the age of 60. So they could look back, they could see who'd had a heart attack, and they could see what was happening at 50. So at 50, the greatest predictor of you having a heart attack at 60 is nothing to do with your food, is nothing to do with how much movement you've been getting, and everything to do with how happy you are with your primary partner. Because how happy you are with your primary partner means a lot about stress, and we know that stress is a huge influence on cardiovascular disease. So that's a huge input. Wow. That I think the way we live our lives these days is, you know, not so focused maybe on the connection between other people. And I mean, like, phones is a big part of that. Everybody's constantly on their phones and nobody's like looking around at nature or the environment anymore. They're just, you know, being lulled into their false sense of connection with their phone.
I've heard of it being referred to as like in Lord of the Rings with my precious, you're just staring down at the phone.
Yeah. It's exactly like that actually, isn't it? When I was talking to Carla Hannaford yesterday, we talked a lot about kids and phones, and that some new research that came out, I didn't catch where she'd got it from, but that it's now kind of believed that kids' brains aren't really capable of dealing with any kind of screen until they're about 14.
Wow.
And I was just like, whoa. And a new study that she had recently heard, that in Germany, 70% of 2-year-olds are watching at least 4 hours of screen time a day. And I was just like, whoa, that is heavy.
Whoa, that is a lot.
It's a lot, yeah. So, yeah, mind-blowing stuff. But, yeah, coming back to that kind of love and connection, one of the reasons I think that she was talking about is, like, kids are just texting each other, and so they don't understand the nuance of reading somebody's facial expression. They can't actually read it. And so that's the movement thing, right? A kinesthetic intelligence to be able to understand how somebody's moving, like their face, and how that leads to an emotional intelligence of you being able to, you know, read somebody and go, oh, they're happy or they're sad or they're, you know, whatever. And so when we kind of are disconnected from the movement of our bodies and from the movement of other people, we're really disconnected from being able to sense our own emotion and from being able to sense the emotion of others. And so, you know, that's why real connection with humans is really, really important, believe it or not.
Seems so obvious. It's so valuable.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to talk about things like, we briefly discussed this at the start with like strollers and baby Bjorns and wraps. So there are so many ways to transport a baby. But I wondered if you could talk about the natural movement for both the adult and the baby when the baby is simply carried in the arms.
Yeah. Well, there's Like the example I want to give is Katie Bowman. She's incredible. You should definitely have a chat with her.
Mm-hmm.
And she, with her children, never used strollers. She carried them, you know, she took her daughter Rowan for a walk, you know, from day one, you know, and she got head control very, very young. And watching those kids move is incredible. They just move so beautifully. And so if you are not required to move a part of your body, you are not going to get the strength in that area. And so if you're lying down constantly on your back, you're not really asking your neck muscles to move. And in terms of, you know, developmental movement patterns, you know, moving the head and the eyes and getting neck control and starting to develop your cervical curve is one of the first things that happens. And so developing that early, I mean, getting means that you simply have to be demanded that your body use it, right? And if your body's not asked to use it, it won't use it. And so you won't get strength in the neck, and therefore you don't have the strength to, you know, lift your head up. Therefore you don't have the strength to roll over. And then we kind of just slowly start to delay the developmental movement patterns. So if you don't want to delay your kids' developmental movement patterns, give them the opportunity to use their bodies so that, you know, they can develop these strengths and develop, you know, the understanding of how to use their body. Because there's this, you know, intricate wiring of the brain happening through the movement of the body. And it's just vital to reach a landmark so that your body has the strength to then go on to the next thing, you know. Nobody goes to rolling until they've got, you know, good neck control, and then nobody goes to crawling until they've got, you know, stability in the hips, and then nobody goes to walking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, until they've learnt those skills. And you reduce a kid's, you know, like if you sit a kid in a, when it can't support itself in some kind of seating device that holds it up, you're just demanding that it doesn't use those parts of it. So it's, they're not going to get stronger, and they're not going to get the use that they need to for that kid to be able to go to the next stage. So in terms of loads for the body, when a hunter-gatherer lady has her baby, she's probably born on the floor, she probably then picks it up and then carries it, wraps it in some kind of, you know, cloth or something, but carries it and then gets back to work, whatever she was doing. And so the baby's going to be shifting around a lot, and just, it's going to have to use its neck muscles, it's going to have to use all of the muscles that it has. It's going to, you know, sleep with its parents. It's going to be asked to do a lot of movement. So it's going to be, you know, before it knows it, play gathering and, you know, doing all of those kind of movements and squatting and whatnot. So when you don't do a movement, you know, like you're just delaying the next movement in terms of the developmental movement patterns. And for the mother, you know, like if you've got a, you know, a bowling ball in your stomach, and you've got good alignment, you've got a really good weight, you know, in terms of conditioning your body, that weight in your belly, your baby is just getting slightly bigger and bigger and bigger every day. So you're getting used to a slightly heavier and heavier and heavier load. And then that comes out. And so now you've got the strength in your body to deal with this load. And then the next, you know, as it gets a bit bigger, the next couple of days. But I mean, carrying a child with your pelvis way out in front of you is not good for your lower back. So I think understanding, you know, what good alignment is, and that you need to have your weight in your heels and those kind of things is, again, really, really important. And a lot of us have developed that anterior thrust of our pelvis because of how much stress there is in our body and then how much time we spend sitting. So there's a lot of things. But I mean, like, if you're carrying a kid, it's great weight training.
Yeah.
You know, I remember Katie telling a story, I don't know where I heard it, about a guy coming up to her and her husband at they're at a fair or a show or something, and Katie and Michael were carrying their children, and this guy was like, you know, like, look at me, I'm a buff dude, I go to the gym every day, and I can't carry my kid for more than kind of 20 minutes without getting a really sore back. How do you do it? And Katie was just like, well, I understand alignment, and I've just done this since they were little, you know. And so the weight, my body is gradually, you know, got accustomed to the increase in weight. And, you know, it just wasn't an issue for them. They were, you know, Michael and Katie were strong, really strong. And this guy who was doing specific movements at the gym was not strong for carrying his child. While he might have been able to bench Katie under the table, he couldn't carry his kid. So it's just, you know, what's important to you and what, you know, but there's that whole idea, like, what good is it being a really good runner if you go and help your mate shift in the weekend and pull a muscle on your back shifting a couch? Or, you know, so we want to be these kind of well-rounded kind of individuals. And Erwin the Core at MoveNet talks about, you know, being strong to be useful. It's not about, you know, being able to, you know, it's like, can you help your neighbors when you need to and not injure your back? And could you help somebody when they really needed you to help them? Is your body strong enough to do what, you know, naturally you'd normally be able to do? I'd like, that's it. You know, all of us have got bodies that are not as strong as they would have been. I like to sometimes imagine what my body would currently look like if I was born in nature and if I had spent every day outside, you know, what would I look like? And I have no doubt that it'd be very different to what my body looks like today. And then I'm like, well, how can I, you know, get a little bit closer to having that body today? And for me, that means doing a lot of walking and a lot of strengthening of the areas that, you know, Western society means that, you know, you just don't use certain parts of your body, so they become very weak. And so doing some exercise so that hopefully eventually I no longer need to do any exercise because I've restored my natural alignment. But I think probably most of us need about 3 or 4 lifetimes to get that done.
Yeah, to undo all the damage that domestication has done to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, are there any like common misconceptions about natural movement?
It depends what you mean by, you know, natural human movement. And I'm using the term natural human movement, not natural movement, because MoveNet has trademarked natural movement with an N, capital N, capital M. So that's just something to be aware of.
I did not know that. Thank you.
So what I think about is, I think there's more misconceptions about exercise. Like, exercise is the invention of a sedentary culture. It is not the way that humans should naturally move. And so most people, when they think about going and do something good for their body, they think about exercise just because that's what we've been told the story for the last 10, 20 years, that if we want to do something good for our body, that we've got to exercise. And that's just not true. You know, it really isn't. To do something good for our body, we have got to spend more time, you know, doing these movements that we did in nature. And like, when we started exercising, nobody went, oh, let's have a look at all of the humans still interacting in the environment in a really natural kind of modern hunter-gatherer way and look at the movements they're doing. Jane Fonda just started, you know, kicking her legs in the air, and, you know, we started doing these specific movements because we thought, oh yeah, they'll be great. Nobody ever kind of went, no, actually, what specific movements do we need? And I know I've talked about Katie a lot, but she's kind of thought about that, and she's gone, well, we need the squat pattern. We need to be able to, you know, lift and carry stuff. We need to be able to walk. We need to be able to hang, swing and climb. And we need to be able to sit on the floor. We need to be able to sit on the ground in many different ways. And so that's the kind of movement that I'm interested in getting for my body. And when I help my clients, especially say my clients with shoulder problems, when I get them hanging, swinging and climbing, they don't have any shoulder problems anymore. When I get my clients with knee issues, hip issues, when I get them walking really well, they don't have knee issues or hip issues anymore. So, and floor sitting, walking and floor sitting for those kind of issues. So I think there's more misconceptions around exercise. I don't think a lot of people, if you say natural human movement, I don't think a lot of people would have any idea what you were talking about. And so it's just like, actually, what, you know, but again, natural human movement is what our body would have had to have done to get us through a day in our natural environment. And that's what I believe natural human movement is. And I don't really believe that many people are getting it, unless you're one of these people still living a modern traditional hunter-gatherer life, such as, you know, the husband, the chamane, the, you know, the there's lots of tribes out there still living in areas, and we study them a lot, the poor people.
Yeah. So what do you think would help to make natural human movement more widely practiced?
If there was more nature. Well, I think this ultimately comes down to the fact that humans have removed themselves from nature. Like, if you ask most humans, even if you Google the definition of nature, it says everything in the world, trees, you know, animals, but not humans and things humans create. And I'm just like, what? I'm pretty sure that a human is part of nature. So we've removed ourselves from the definition of nature. So that means we're not a part of it, right? So that means that why would we go and be in nature? Because we've got nothing to do with nature, which is just complete and utter rubbish. And it means that we can destroy it. So I mean, really, from a deeper level, I think that to get more people doing more natural movement, there needs to be this understanding that we are part of nature and we thrive in it. You know, we need, you know, phytoncybins from trees. That is a nutrition that we need. If you don't spend enough time with trees, you don't get enough of that in your system. When, you know, there are things from nature, it is part of that we actually physically need for our cellular function. So we need more nature. We need to reintegrate with nature. And I don't think we need to go back and live in caves. I think there is very much a way that we can spend way more time in nature and still have a very kind of traditional modern life. So, you know, I don't really want to go back and live in a cave, but some people do. So yeah, it's a very interesting topic. You know, I've just read Sapiens and Homo Deus and 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari. And he is an incredible thinker. And, you know, I'd love to hear what he'd answer to that question, actually. How would you get more humans involved in, you know, natural human movement? That you've got to let them know that it's important. And I mean, like, we've let all the humans in the world know how important exercise is to them, and yet nobody's really exercising. So I think that having a connection to a place and actually wanting to go and visit that place, and, you know, like I mentioned at the start, O'Kane's Bay, we used to go there all the time. So having that connection to a place makes you want to go there and kind of interact with the outside environment. So, you know, do you have a special kind of outdoor place that you just like to be in? I've got very many of those up on the Port Hills that I want to get to, not to do some exercise, but just because I like hanging out in those places. So yeah, there's lots to talk about there.
Yeah. Okay, so I will put links in the show notes to your Mind and Movement website and the books and videos
cool.
mentioned today. Where else could people go to find out more or get in contact with you or attend your workshops?
Well, I don't have Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Well done.
Which is awesome. Yeah, I've got off that. I'm about to start, just my website is the best place to go.
Yeah.
I am about to start putting a whole lot more content up there. So in the next couple of months, it'll be a much more interesting place to look at than it is now. Yeah, but just there pretty much. And a lot of the corporate health consulting I do is through it's through businesses. So if you wanted me to run a course at your business or whatever, you'd just get in touch at through my website.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. Hazel, thank you so much for sharing this knowledge with us today. I've truly enjoyed speaking with you. Do you have any final words?
No, thank you so much. It's always fun to talk about movement to somebody else who's really interested in movement. So yeah, thank you so much. Everybody should actually go and check out the MoveNet website, Katie Bowman's nutritious movement website. They've actually done a really cool collab recently.
Ah, cool.
And it's on MoveNet's website. It's their e-course. Katie is leading the first part of every class, and then Danny from MoveNet is leading the second part. I got a lot out of that course. I think everybody should check that out if they're interested in just kind of wrapping their head around what natural human movement is and whatnot.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and all of your favourite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.